Okay, we're all here. All right, well, thank you all for kind of sticking it out until now. And we have, we'll try and be good and end by 6:30. I think an hour will be good for us, and then everyone can start drinking. Or slurping oysters, whatever your preference is. All right, my opening address is going to be very brief, just to kind of set the stage, and then Richard has a few slides, and then I'll let each of the panelists kind of self-introduce themselves and make some comments, as we did before, about this space. And then I think we've had plenty of introduction to this theme throughout the day, whether it's about issues of pricing, whether it's about issues of toxicity, whether it's about issues of how to think about, like most recently in the slides were just shown by Bill, about the kind of novel combinations to get MRD negativity and then maybe stopping. So it's obviously a consistent theme in an oncology. So I think while we all have always known and have always utilized combinations in oncology, I think this has really been brought to the fore in terms of kind of the commercial aspects of combinations and the direct linkage between the clinical utility and commercial thinking with the approval that GSK had both for their BRAF V600 mutation and their MEK inhibitors. And a number of articles kind of ensued following that development about, you know, in kind of the emboldening of the industry to think more about this from very early on, about changes that have been happening in regulatory agencies to help facilitate this, about clinical trials, about the kind of the science that enables, and we'll talk about all these issues, but certainly in immuno-oncology, a huge amount of this kind of real-time experimenting happening in the clinic with patients as we try to figure out what are the best combinations. And if you look at what many companies, how they're positioning themselves, you see a lot of this on their websites or their R&D presentations, such as here from Novartis, about kind of showing, kind of trying to shut down the pathways that are involved and kind of the illustration of the various drugs that they have and the kind of the more the schematic of the different nodes and the programs that they have. Again, just looking at internal combinations with the idea of trying to kind of completely block these several pathways, multiple pathways, which again is a theme we've heard throughout the day, and Pfizer also. So pretty much everyone's been doing these type of either early stage deals or collaborative clinical trial issues. When clearly thinking about these, there are a lot of issues that span the whole gamut of basically, you know, what we talk about in this conference every year, and what we do day in, day out at Define Health is really kind of trying to triangulate those kind of the scientific rationale underpinning these combinations, whether they may be internal, fully internal to a company, or whether they be an internal and external combination. In other words, seeking to combine one's agent with an external partner, which is something that is starting to happen more and more. And again, with immuno-oncology, you know, really leading a lot of the way these past few days. So, and then what are the endpoints that one needs to achieve? So what is that target product profile? If you're going to make a combination, whether it's internal or internal external, because you want to have something that's going to be clinically meaningful at the end of the day. And, of course, then that implies other issues in terms of how you dose, obviously what the additive toxicities might be, and clearly the kind of the value aspects, and not least of which is the kind of approval process for doing so. And these slides will be available. So at the end of the day, when you kind of weigh and think about all these different parameters, certainly if you're just looking at an internal portfolio, say in the case of Novartis, and trying to figure out how from a kind of the scientific standing of a combination, the kind of the potential clinical value that you might get out of that, as well as the commercial synergies for the franchises that might accrue, at the end of the day, you might end up with a matrix that only gives you a limited number of things that really have substantive enough data at present to pursue actively. Others maybe are maybe a little backburnered, and some others you may simply park until data is more mature, and this can clearly become more complicated when you're looking both at your internal pipeline and trying to see what external programs might be available to provide that synergy. So a number of things, again, have been touched on today, but I think the one that I think we really want to think about are, you know, these challenges increasingly of trying to demonstrate the value. So that was the very first session we had. It's going to run throughout the day, whether these are internal, or internal, external. You know, trying to determine what that bar is that you have to set that's not only going to be relevant to the clinical needs, and not just from the standpoint of simply getting approved, but getting approved and being very meaningful to those clinicians, and therefore, you know, more importantly for the patients who are going to be receiving them, but also to the payers. And so really determining what that that increment needs to be. And sometimes it can be incremental. In some cancers, you know, anything you can achieve through those combinations is valuable. In other settings, those commercial competition and the clinical trial competition, et cetera, sets a much higher bar. And say to the point of, you know, do we need, you know, X number of ALK agents? That's one type of story. It's a very different story, and we heard a number of times brought up today about, you know, how many, you know, six or eight anti-PD or PD-L1 agents there are. And I think one has to bear in mind that there are a lot of interesting issues behind that. It's not to think that these are simply, say, in the case of those PD agents, that these are just me too's. It's as much an issue of kind of clinical trial and ultimately commercial strategies of being able to control an asset that you know is going to be important in combination. And if you've got other novel targets, then the question is, are you better off collaborating with the leaders, such as a BMS or a Merck, or controlling your own PD agent plus whatever unique novel target you may have internally? And I think we need to be careful and not kind of lump all these kind of me toos into the same issue, because different things apply to each of them. So at the end of the day, what we'll do in this panel is try and talk about some of the issues, whether they're small molecules or large molecules, or maybe even we'll touch on the CARTs has been brought up, because we do know that we want to be in a combination world. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Richard to kind of present his viewpoint, and then we'll proceed Thank through you. The panel and then get into a nice dialogue. And hopefully people will be engaged enough. Because if I don't get any questions from the audience, I'm going to hold cocktails at ransom. So
you can bring them in.
So this slide from the Weinberg and Hanahan paper I put up, which it keeps reappearing in various forms, but just to show, you know, that you know, cancer is a complex disease, and if you're in pharma, there's a lot of different targets that that you can work at. And the reason there's a lot of different targets is there's a lot of complexity to the cancer, or most cancers. And it really starts with the tumor. It starts with the microenvironment. It starts with the immune system. And there are a lot of vulnerabilities that you see with cancer. But I'd say over the past dozen years or so, understanding has improved a lot. What really becomes one of the major issues is you can deal with simple driver mutations and stuff, but if you listen through the course of the day, the thing that in the end that really gets back to is how will you deal with resistance and how will you deal with tumor heterogeneity? And to me, those are the big, you know, the big issues that we need to deal with, and that's why combinations are not attractive but necessary. The other thing I think now, I think the whole field is really, there's a lot of excitement that the past hasn't been good enough, that the science, the day of science is here, we're getting a lot better at making drugs, we understand at least to some extent the immune system, and we want better outcomes. And I think it's really all those things, that's in the background, is how do we do better. So, you know, I'll just show this slide, and it just shows, again, whether you're dealing with the tumor, whether you're dealing with the microenvironment, the heterogeneity, there's a lot of potential targets. I'd say the other thing is things that's really changed. Genetics has really changed in terms of our understanding of both the tumor and the immune system. Mechanisms of resistance, I think we're beginning to understand more. Part of it's due to heterogeneity, part of it's due to some stem cell component, and part of it's due when you treat a cancer and then relook, you're rewiring it with every type of treatment. Drugs, I think, have gotten better, gotten much better at making antibodies, bispecifics now, chemistry is better with some structure-based design. And pathways, while we don't understand them in detail, we understand them better. And with biomarkers, we've kind of been bashing biomarkers a bit today, but again, if you look where we are now with sequencing, with some of the proteomics and stuff, we're actually in a much better shape than what we were. So we want to improve outcomes, and we want to combine drugs to treat heterogeneity and resistance. So the bottom line is one of the issues for pharma and all of us is there's really no good predictive models. We're getting better with PDX models, with some of the syngeneic models for immunotherapy, but that's really one of the major issues. How can you get better predictive models? And I think where many of us are, we use these, but we also want tumor tissues, and we want to know what the outcomes of patients are linked with trial outcomes, and that's important. What are the optimal combinations? Where should you start? Do you start up front, or do you start in later lines of the disease? And I think that remains a big question. And while we all want combinations, we have to give a dose and a schedule because tolerability is a big, big issue. Can you combine two of these agents, three of these agents? What is the appropriate schedule? And then in the end, efficacy and durability. What kind of endpoints do you want to use? Response rate, PFS, overall survival, and how do you get to, how do you get early on to say there's a signal here? And I think that's an important thing. I discussed safety and tolerability. And again, what patients do you go into? And cancer is complicated, as we all know. What line of therapy do you go into? Each disease is different. The genetics is different. Where do you go with the right combination? Because, again, tailoring becomes very important. And finally, an issue that's come up a lot is cost. As we partner more and more expensive drugs and partner drugs between different companies and novel agents, who's going to bear the cost and what's the whole pricing model? So I'd say that the bottom line, it's not if we should do combinations. Combinations are here. How can we do them better? How can we combine them with genetic and biomarkers? How do we have something that's going to be affordable? And how can we move the field quicker to get what we all want, which is better outcomes for patients with, especially with metastatic disease?
Thank you. My name is Naomi Rosa, and for the last 4 years, I was the early commercial strategy head for GSK Oncology and also leading their commercial group responsible for business development activity. I am now with Novartis Oncology as of the recent acquisition. And from my perspective, first of all, thank you for inviting me to Find Health to be a member of this panel. From my perspective, historically, I believe that oncology combo development has been a backbone of oncology drug development. However, more recently, there has been a major paradigm shift, as we have listened to from various speakers, in terms of how the space is evolving with the advent of immunotherapies, different drivers of that paradigm shift, such as regulatory approvals happening more quickly, and also different combinations that are no longer just with standards of care, but immunotherapies in combination with immunotherapies, novel combinations of targeted therapies, and also we heard earlier from the cellular therapy panel that potentially cellular therapy in combination with checkpoint modulators coming soon. So from a commercial perspective, I feel that for sponsors, especially sponsors that have robust oncology pipelines, it's really important for the early commercial strategy function to be integrated into the rest of the organization, working very closely with clinical development, translational research, market access, and other major manufacturing, et cetera, to ensure that from the get-go there is differentiation built into the development of these combinations. And, you know, I'd like to use a quote by Hai Levitsky, mentioned earlier, one of our speakers and one of the other panels, In terms of combination therapy, the combination in many instances is the drug. So I think it's really important because everything's happening so much earlier than in the past, and there is a lot happening in the field as a result of all of the different partnerships and business development activity happening across the entire industry, that there's a very close alignment. I like to think of it as an attached at the hip kind of approach in terms of how commercial partners with clinical development and the R&D organization, including discovery.
So thanks for this opportunity. I would like to maybe just touch the base on biologics and multi-targeting. Clearly, some of the previous speakers, and as well as the beautiful slide from Hanagan, probably the most quoted slide we use in our presentations, show that there's a various aspect how the tumor can be addicted and how the tumor can progress and acquire resistance. And the recent data, maybe starting 2011-12, showing the tumor heterogeneity play an important role as well as the tumor plasticity. So the question is, to date, we have quite a few toys to play with, and clearly the development of this multi-targeting therapy is very costly and very lengthy. So the way how we look in my company this is that how we can do it as faster and more effectively. So the first question is really what target one can combine, and there are various tools to really look at this. It's clear the tumor is pre-wired, and if you look a little knockout or any other strategies, you can find out that some of the receptor families, they can be very easily substitute for each other. So you knock out from her family, for instance, one, and second, her two or her three or her four can really step in. And there are other very good examples from IGF receptor family or MET. So the way we look at it is that a lot of work has to be done in vitro and in preclinical models before one can, from theoretical point of view, to come with a combination biologics. Very important is to take in the complexity of the microenvironment and the ligands. The next step is where currently the preclinical models can take us, and there are a lot of limitations primarily from historical xenograft point of view. PDX models catapult us to a different orbit with some limitations. Clearly the immune system is not preserved there, although there are ways to get around as well. And these days, more commonly than ever before, we are using preclinical phase 2 studies before we enter the clinic. Problem which we will be facing, and was alluded to in the morning discussion, is combination therapy in immunomodulatory or immune checkpoints. It's not only a synergistic efficacy, but synergistic toxicity. And unfortunately, we still have a lot of limitations using cynomolgus monkeys or any other models to predict what will be really the right way to take it to the clinic. Now, multi-targeting can address, as I mentioned, the tumor plasticity as well as the tumor heterogeneity. The question is how to enrich the patient population. It was mentioned all over the day to really sort of fish out the population which can benefit from the therapies more effectively. If I think Genentech didn't have a data on HER2 amplification from data from Dennis Lehman, I'm sure that development of the Herceptin will be much, much more difficult and more costly. It will take many more years to develop it. So the challenge is how to really bring this to the clinic faster.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Ivan. I'm Eric Rowinsky. I'm the head of R&D for the small company uptown, Stemline Therapeutics, of targeting cancer stem cells. And thank you for the invitation again, Jeff. And I'll send you my expense reimbursement for a subway ride. so I thought I started to draw up some slides, and I realized I was probably on a panel like this last year or the year before where we discussed combination therapies, and I think close to the cocktail hour I would be filling you with a bunch of conjecture. So I thought I'd give you sort of my feelings about combination strategies, largely with regard to immuno-oncology. It's still going to be conjecture and hyperbole, but why not? I have you trapped in the room. You know, I don't know. You get very biased. We're all biased. We're all subject to bias. And it just can't be avoided. We're all humans. And we kind of think about tumors in a way we've been programmed. And I've certainly been programmed in the world of chemotherapy, and I grew up in that era and grew up thinking about cytoreduction and, you know, how we needed to kill logs and logs of cells with combinations and heterogeneity of tumors and the need to utilize agents that target a variety of very relevant targets. And gee, I've been sort of blown away over the last 2 to 3 years. I think it just hit my world with regard to immuno-oncology, particularly the PD-1, PD-L1, CTLA-4, checkpoint inhibitors, and this whole notion of tolerance, and just seeing solid tumors, and I've treated many of these patients in the clinic, head and neck cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, bladder cancer, and several other ones with regard to having relevant responses, or at least near-relevant responses with single-agent therapy. It just highlighted how much bias, because I never would have gone there. If I was in charge of developmental programs, it certainly wouldn't have been on my hit list with regard to targeting solid tumors. And so when I think about combinations, and I think we've, as a group, were on the phone a couple of weeks ago, and I started thinking about this, gee, you know, how many immunotherapeutic modulations, T-cell modulations, antibodies that haven't worked, vaccines. Gee, we have lists of vaccines against targets, multivalent vaccines, tumor vaccines, DNA vaccines, you know, lists of therapies that just haven't worked, but yet there's really been a strong rationale for these therapies based upon science, based upon some models. And just think about how we could kind of revive potentially these therapeutic classes, particularly vaccines, which if you think about it, could really make a great impact theoretically in really early cancer and really annihilating early cancers. If we combined with potential checkpoint inhibitors and tolerance modifiers. So I kind of think that we really have to get back. We really have to pull these classes of agents that had major impacts, potentially have major impacts, off the shelf again, and start to look at them in a new light with these tolerance modifiers, with PD-1 inhibitors, with checkpoint inhibitors. I'm just kind of using that provocatively, because I just see that. You know, there's a whole world out there that we have to learn about, and you know, I'm not sure that we have the models for this. And I think sometimes, and now I believe that we have some better models with regard to the checkpoint inhibition, but certainly not combinations of checkpoint inhibitors and vaccines. I think we need to learn by doing, and. I think it's going to be very interesting because, you know, just to think about what's going on out there strategically, there are several of these agents approved. If I wanted to combine my vaccine with a checkpoint modifier to basically modify tolerance and potentially augment the effects of a vaccine that wouldn't basically impact otherwise, I'm going to really have to call upon the big boys. I'm going to have to call upon Bristol and Merck and AstraZeneca and Novartis and, you know, and I think that they are, and this presents some problems for biotech. I think that there's going to be priority lists at the companies that have PD-1 inhibitors, priority lists that are based upon the synthesis of, finance, synthesis of do we combine with agents in our armamentarium? Do we go outside to biotech companies? And I think that's why we're seeing many companies in-license Me Toos to avoid having to be on the bottom of a priority list. And it's going to be interesting with regard to what happens with respect to the politics of combinations and what gets combined and whose drug gets combined. So I think it's a brave new world, but I also think that it's going to be important to learn by doing. I'm not sure that the models are going to be predictive for those. And believe me, I think the models are getting better. And certainly I think some of the panelists can discuss those models better than I can. But they're certainly not going to be there for combinations of other immune modulatory agents, T cell modifiers, vaccines, and we are going to have to learn by doing. And you know, I think it presents great opportunities for us. It really does. So anyway, I'll stop with my hyperbole, and hopefully that'll be somewhat provocative.
So that sets us up well, Eric. Thank you, and all of you. So, any questions before I start launching in with my questions? Oh, good, Jeremy. Thank you. Cocktail for you.
Question for Dr. Gaynor. When you think about combinations that are novel, who is taking the lead in terms of biomarkers? Is it the company that's, if it's you, taking an agent from yours? And what do you do if it's a development agent which is not approved or there's not a companion diagnostics? How do you think about tracking the combination?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question, and, you know, we're kind of feeling our way through this. The bottom line in collaborations we've done, what we've done at least initially, is we're going to share tissues. We will agree that we'll each do biomarkers that we're comfortable with, and depending upon what we find, we'll then partner with a diagnostic company and then go to the FDA as a group, and that's kind of what the plan is.
Thank you.
See, your audience takes cocktail threats very seriously. We have our
first time anyone ever has, but yes. All right.
So I think the panel touched on it in the great discussion this point. I was just curious your opinions. Combination is the drug. So starting with that, the question is around regulatory development and even market access models that we have, which are essentially designed around the paradigm of agents that have, in their own right, some single agent activity that could then be synergistically combined for even better results. We don't seem to have these models designed for things that don't really have single agent activity worth anything, but as modulators, as combination partners, have brilliant activity. Now, how do we get them to market? What's sort of your thought?
Well, there are several, examples. The MAC-RAF inhibitors, an example of that. But I think you brought up two questions. There's a couple of ways these combinations can go. If you have one drug approved, then it's easier to combine a second drug and, then get that approved. I think what you're talking about are two unapproved agents, neither that really would have an approval process by itself that you want to get as a novel. And the FDA has, really expressed and given a lot of regulation to that point. It's doable. They've told you what you need and stuff. But, I think as a paradigm moving forward, I think we still need a lot to learn in that and what the economics are going to be and everything. I think it remains kind of an open question, but a really good point that you raised. And we'll need to see more of those moving forward to really know what the landscape's going to be. And two, for how you're going to pay for it. Do you pay for the combo? And what about if you want to test another drug in another indication? So that's a good point.
Well, I think it's also interesting, and one comment.
One way we can look at it is that there has to be a pretty strong science and courage in any R&D organization to take forward compound which doesn't have any activity. But if you look at a pertuzumab, which really single agent activity was not there, and clearly there was a beautiful synergy with Herceptin. So if the science is there, I'm pretty sure the FDA will be open for any dialogue. But it will require a lot of internal courage and energy and financials to go forward.
But classically, it's... Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. But classically, I'll just brief comment. It's the FDA has generically required that the combination show the robust activity greater than and pretty irrefutably greater than single-agent activity. So, it begs the question... will they? And they've certainly spoken to that point. As far as knowing robust activity when they see it, I think that they've certainly approved the GSK combination on that basis. But I think that there are also you know, a lot of interesting platforms where one could actually put various new chemical entities in a single platform and call it a single new clinical entity. For example, if one took a nanoparticle and that carried two new entities or targeted therapeutics, you can potentially, you know, circumvent that whole need to show the agency that the combination of two agents were better than each of them, because now it was one chemical entity. So there actually may be companies that are able to short track those considerations.
Well, you could even argue that, you know, engineered CAR T cells, it's a combination product, and it'll only get more so
some bispecifics.
I think one really good example of an agent that has been very successful from the commercial perspective that had very modest single agent activities, Avastin. I think it's one of the classical examples. But back to your question, I think that also it really depends upon the collaboration and the partnership. So if you're thinking about an internal portfolio partnership or combination, I think that the sponsor has greater control than if it's a collaboration with another pharma or biotech company or even academia. It gets a little bit more complex.
I'm sorry. There's another example, even from your world of cytotoxics. Oxaliplatin drug has never been approved as a single agent and clearly only as a combination therapy. So I would not worry. I think, again, if the science is there and preclinical data can support it, I would be very surprised that agency will not allow you to go to phase one program.
However, you know, many drugs that have very limited single agent activity and require combinations, you know, obviously most biotech companies can't develop them because, sure, you know, it requires a phase one trial of a single agent phase, and then a combination phase one trial, and then a randomized trial. And so partnerships are going to be important. I think for drugs, many of the drugs that even Avastin, you can demonstrate single agent activity robustly in a tumor type such as renal cancer that for monotherapy and then move forward after approval. So we always look for that single agent way that one could leap forward and then do combinations. But again, it's very difficult to for many of the companies that are developing novel therapies that may not make a difference as a single agent but may require combinations to move those forward because of fiscal reasons. And I think many of these agents may be dying on the vine.
Well, I think your comment earlier about the vaccines that, you know,
vaccines
clearly
may be one
you
of
know
them.
Would have benefit and going forward will benefit from combination with, you know, the release that a anti PD-1 or other checkpoint would be able to
Hopefully.
Provide. Whereas on their own, you in many cases were able to show some type of immune response, but not necessarily any clinical response that was meaningful. We even have some companies in the audience. I don't know if anyone wants to make any comments about the single agent activity where it's minimal and where you're dependent on being combined with an approved agent or something. I have someone in mind if you want to pipe in. Ada?
Thanks for that plug.
Sure.
So, as we were discussing earlier today, innate immune cell modulation certainly requires, in many cases, complement activation at the tumor site. And so for the glucan compounds and imprime PGG in particular, which Biothera develops, there is a clear mandate, as we understand it right now, to concurrently administer a complement-activating antibody. So the way that we have gotten around some of the clinical trial challenges there is to really combine with standard of care approved and reimbursed therapy, even as a small, even pre-IPO company, where at least in the United States, clinical trial participation does not preclude reimbursement of the standard of care therapy as a backbone.
Right. Any other questions? Yes, two questions.
I'm sorry, not a question, just a
comment.
Just a closing. The most difficult the most difficult conversations in that discussion are not agency so much as as the mornings, pair discussions. So now the scenario is really, and it's just a closing comment really, we've had many of these where which partner actually contributes to combo efficacy, to what degree, and how do you price them individually, particularly if they are not both from your own stable. And those are some really challenging discussions that we will see evolve as we go.
Just to continue this, although we may have exhausted the conversation, I mean, maybe an analogy is similar to what we saw in the last decade in HIV therapy, for example, where every company, you know, realized that they had to come up with a cocktail. If you had a novel reverse transcriptase, you couldn't do much with it by itself, but you had to put it into combos with those companies that were already far along, or even the mania for hepatitis drugs a few years ago. Everybody wanted to get it, those that were already in the hepatitis space wanted to grab other possible molecules that they would combine. So I don't know if that's the direction we're going in. The only positive I see about that is if the large company actually has those assets, it can start to think about price flexibility when it finally has the right combo that it wants to go forward with.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That was one of the points on the slides, which you can see in more detail because there are a lot of text on it. But certainly, you know, the ability to, I think, control your franchise, control the clinical development, and all that entails is greatly facilitated if you actually do have, you know, both those partners in hand. I don't know if anyone else wants to talk about it.
The Gilead's cocktail may be a good example of, I believe that... blocking names, I mean, the hepatitis...
Slovati.
Yeah, which doesn't have... which has two single agents that did not demonstrate compelling activity or would not or have not yet been until the combination was actually evaluated in the cocktail. So, you know, it does potentially demonstrate the FDA's, you know, moving attitudes towards... combination.
Coming from NCI, I'm really impressed historically how rapidly the drug can be developed these days for hepatitis C or HIV. And so clearly one challenge in front of all of us is how to prioritize the development of the, let's say, immune checkpoints, not only talking about a biosimilar or, you know, different portfolio for different large company, but really where is the patient pool to really develop these agents? Forget even the financial aspect, and clearly Eric is right that small biotech company will not be able to do it. They will have to partner with somebody. But even a big pharma, if you have in the U.S. 3% of the patients that participate in clinical trials, I'm almost certain that's not the case in hepatitis C field or HIV. So I think there's a bigger hurdle for oncology space to advance some of these very, very exciting agents.
Just make one comment, I think, to your point. And Eric raised it, too. So if it comes up later on that you need PD-1, CTLA-4, and immune checkpoint X, and that's going to be a baseline regimen, what are companies, how can you afford to ever do the trials, you know, to really show that your agent added to this or even competing to it is going to be something that's relevant. Just the cost of doing these type of trials becomes prohibitive, I think, for a lot of companies.
Yep. You have to make your own.
Any other questions right now? Or? All right, so we kind of leapt right into commercial and regulatory and payer issues. I want to go back a little bit to the science that we've touched on, I think, all of you in turn. But this aspect of, and maybe this touches on some of those wild speculations that you had in your previous slides from 2 years ago, Eric, but I think it is worthwhile at least to briefly discuss the idea of how does one think about, you know, putting these combinations together, right? There's the purely empiric, let's just, you know, throw a bunch of things, or the fishing expedition, I think, as someone called on the phone. There's the much more rational driven, let's go for synthetic lethality with kind of targets we know and or suspect or have been at least semi-proven to have some type of a synergistic activity. Tell me a little bit kind of, you know, your own particular biases that way. And that also ties into the idea of, you know, shutting down a single pathway with multiple agents as opposed to shutting down multiple pathways. And they're not mutually exclusive either. It just starts to add up in terms of the number of drugs.
So I will take it. So the way we do it in the first step, we are challenging the pathways, something very similar to synthetic lethality, and see how the system is rewired. So you try not to kill the cells necessarily, but to see which pathway is going to take over. And it's pretty surprising that if you take 200, 300 different cell lines, different origin, different molecular signature, you can find a certain pattern. And using this now, these days when you have a lot of silencing RNA available, you can really easier to identify potential partners. And then you can test your hypothesis in vivo models. And that's usually the strategy, what we are using. I don't think that small biotech company can afford the brutal force and say, we just empirically combine A, B, C, D. That was nice in 1980s, but not in 2015.
And are you doing that predominantly with your own, you know, with basically biologic combinations, or are you?
We are doing almost exclusively biologics with the eyes on rewiring oncogene addiction and a different pair of receptors. And plus, we are doing it in a term that we develop internally, various cell lines with acquired resistance, and try to overcome this resistance using our own biologics. That's correct.
So how about you, Richard, particularly where you have the chance to both use small molecules, antibodies?
Well, I mean, you know, the bottom line is you like a good scientific rationale for whatever you combine. The bottom line, though, is there's some empiricism here, and each tumor is different. If you take Notch pathway, which I think's come up today, some tumors it promotes tumorigenesis. If you inhibit gamma secretase, and other, it's a suppressor. And so I think it's different for each tumor and line of therapy. If you can get some good preclinical data, if you can get some good data from tumors, that is extremely helpful. And I think, though empiricism and small trials with good endpoints and a good scientific rationale is also very important. So I think it's got to really be a mixture of things.
Any comments?
Yeah, I'd like to comment that from the commercial perspective, again, I think that because of the evolving landscape in oncology, it's important to think of combinations not only as part of the life cycle management as we used to in the past, but from the get-go, planned prospectively.
So one aspect that we haven't directly touched on, and this is a lead-in for you, Eric, is, you know, different mechanisms or targets may entail not only the obvious fact you want to combine them, but different ways to actually want to combine them in the clinical trial. So if one thinks about targeting stem cells versus combining targeting with things that are going to hit a bulk tumor, clearly, you know, there may be particular ways that one wants to do that as in clinical development, as well as ultimately, you know, how they get administered to the patients. Can you talk a little about that, or?
I guess I can try, but I
wing it.
You know, no, I think often, you know, we again, it's this bias, and I think Yvonne was talking about screening, and I think what we need are very unbiased screening systems that, you know, utilize, you know, cell lines and combinations in ways that that. You know, I see pathways. I don't know. I tend to think in these pathways, and I know I'm totally wrong. Well, I mean, cells don't have pathways. There's probably a gamish of chaos that occurs with, and I think that the empiricism works sometimes. Certainly, I think we don't have the model, so we sort of have to jump in. But I really like the development of unbiased systems for screening. I think we tend to, utilize these foundations that we've kind of that are totally wrong sometimes. And I know I'm getting off track, but I think we need to develop more of these mathematical screens, more high throughput screening for combinations.
you know, I remember that, you know, there was a lot of focus on the two major pathways. For some reason, Merck and AstraZeneca got together, and they were targeting PI3 kinase and the MAP kinase system, and you know that was a combination that was going to save man. But that was all based upon a bias, you know, and probably not on some unbiased mathematical high throughput screening. I think we need to do more of that. I think also it's much easier when one has a premise based on an unbiased system that two or three molecules are going to be effective, to utilize novel ways to combine them, so that we're doing drug development of one drug, maybe putting three or two moieties in a nanoparticle. I really like that that premise. I know Bind is actually doing some work on that right now, and there are several other companies that are actually working in that mode. You know, just trying to have one clinical entity or new chemical entity that will get around a lot of the hurdles, the regulatory hurdles, and maybe even some of the commercial hurdles.
Which is equivalent to a multivalent biologic.
Or a multivalent vaccine.
Or a vaccine. But, yeah.
Or a bispecific.
Questions? Andrew?
Nobody answered Jeff's question, which is really a crucial question.
Thank you, Andrew.
I, as many other people in this room, have probably been at sessions at AACR where they say, you know, cancer stem cells are the center of the universe. You're barking up the wrong tree. You're going down a blind pathway. We're not targeting what Dr. Iwinski's company is trying to target, which is the cancer stem cells. And so I'm worried about immuno-oncology because, at least in some cases, cancer stem cells have similar characteristics to normal stem cells, and the body's not going to easily use its own T cells or other even adopted T cells to kill the cancer stem cells. So I just really wanted to, I mean, I know it's kind of late, everybody wants to have some drinks, and I do too, but Jeff, you raised a very important question that nobody has really addressed.
Well, I don't know if immuno-oncology won't target cancer stem cells. Maybe it will target it more effectively, and, you know, there are immune targets on cancer stem cells that are not present or not expressed, but again, it's a big maybe. But I tend to agree with you. I think stem cells are very important, but, you know, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, and of course that implies a certain way of targeting, as I said before, that you need to, you know, you need to somehow sequence those to kill the bulk tumor cell, assuming if you have a very specific cancer stem cell target that's not shared with the bulk tumor, and then you may be able to hit that cancer stem cell, and that may be done after you've done the cytoreductive hit, which then leads me actually to...
But, you know, it could be that the immune system is that we're performing immunosurveillance functions largely in the stem cells that become cancer stem cells.
Absolutely, and they're responsible for immunosuppression.
So
it could be that 15-20% who respond, you know, to single agent, you know, checkpoint inhibitors, maybe there is some inherent activation towards those.
So it would be interesting to test that hypothesis.
Yeah. So that does lead up to the somewhat complicated issue that was addressed in the immuno-oncology panel. You did notice, I'm sure, everyone, how often the discussion's coming back to immuno-oncology on this combination panel, even though everyone's got a diversity of targets and programs here. This issue of the idea of sequencing, right? So one thing is to put things together, and it's another thing to figure out how to optimize putting those together, which is not just, you know, what to put together, but when to put them together. You know, is A best with B, before or after B? Any kind of thoughts or comments about, you know, how to do that? Because, you know, it's much harder to do in an industrialized way, as you know, Eric was suggesting, kind of an unbiased. But Richard?
Well, I mean, I know one thing we look at, you know, in any time we try to combine with an immunotherapy agent is going to be, what's the role of your small molecule inhibitor or antibody on T cell proliferation, T cell killing? And so I think those assays, which, you know, are not bad, are critical before you would go ahead and go into anything in the clinic. So we look at that. Now, there's examples in melanoma with BRAF inhibitors that can augment immune T cell killing. So I think, you know, and a number of these compounds, which you think, well, these may affect T-cell proliferation or something. Surprisingly, don't, though we find others that do. So I think having some good preclinical models using human cells and stuff before you combine are really important. Then, you know, the bottom line is you need to get into the clinic and look in your combinations and basically in the tumor, ideally. Is there anything in this combination that's either augmenting T-cells into the tumor, macrophages, anything in the periphery, and you really can got to know as you're doing these studies where you are, both with the immune cells and the tumor cells, and I think it's really, you know, doing good clinical science as you're moving these things forward.
So do you think, and it all comes down then to those early, you know, whether they're phase zero or other types of early studies that it is, I mean, Ira Mellman, in reference specifically to immuno-oncology, talked about it's now a grand human experiment, right? You've got to put these combinations into people. Now, we could argue that maybe that's more true than just in immuno-oncology, because if you take the example of combining anti-EGF and anti-VEGF, animal models said yes, at least the studies as they were designed in humans said no. So just any thoughts from panelists about kind of this need to ultimately really do these combination tests in humans?
So if you look at the data from Stanford, from Ron Levy's group, there are some immunocombination which can be predicted from a preclinical, and actually there are some very nice data with anti-CD137 and Herceptin and rituximab. But there will be a lot of combination which unfortunately will have to go to the clinic. I don't think that it was very nicely discussed in a very forceful way in the morning. If the preclinical model can predict, then unfortunately, I believe personally that it's more likely not that you will have to go to a clinic. The challenge is that how many permutations you can do in a clinic, how costly it will be, how long it takes, and who's going to pay for it.
I got out of the lab when I realized that I can rig any model to make it work. And what does work mean? What does it works mean? And what's a measure of success in an animal model? What kind of splaying of a growth curve or a growth inhibition curve really translates into something that's clinically relevant? So I think that that's one reason why we often fail, because we just... there's a magnitude of difference. We don't know. Not only are we potentially using models that are over-predictive or, you know, totally not congruent with the clinic, but we haven't been able to understand, or we do and we don't want to see it, but the effect size that's necessary that's going to translate into a human effect, and that's something that I think we can probably go back and look. Drugs that have failed probably don't budge. Or don't have that effect size, or maybe don't induce regressions, et cetera, in models that are relatively good.
Yes. Well, from a commercial perspective, we always follow the science, obviously. when the science and the data are compelling across a number of different indications or tumor types, then there has to be a very strategic and concerted effort to do a prioritization of the indications in terms of the launch strategy or clinical development strategy, which would impact, obviously, pricing and other components of market access. So I think that as long as the data and the science are very compelling, again, commercial always follows the the compelling data, and if more than one indication is on the radar screen, then it's really important to have that discussion around how to prioritize.
Other questions? What? Yes? No? Maybe? No. No? Wait.
I think this is a really critical challenge, especially in an environment in which you really have to applaud the industry for working very quickly to bring new treatments forward to patients, as was the recent case with dabrafenib and trametinib and pembrolizumab and nivolumab and melanoma. So where we find ourselves now is with these new agents and the possibility of potentially stepping back in the dosing of those agents if they were used in combination. And it's frankly a kind of an elephant in the room, on whose dime are those studies explored, Are we going to sell more units of milk because we're, you know, more units of these drugs because we're selling them to more people more effectively? Mm-hmm. I feel as though I want to press the panel to speak more on this, because this is an incredibly important challenge for all of us who might be patients someday.
She said panelists, not moderators. Who wants to step up to that?
I don't know.
Uh-oh.
I think
Luis is scared them all. All right.
Next question.
No, it's great.
Well, I mean, I think that
more rhetorical.
I mean, we have touched on this throughout the course of the day. I think this challenge of these combinations and the value. In fact, in my opening talk, I did kind of address it, kind of what. And I have to assume that, you know, in any of these companies, particularly the large companies, who have not only they're testing their own internal portfolios, but hopefully they're looking early on outward, as Naomi indicated, some companies have, for those combinations. But then, you know, the key decision is really what you said, is that, you know, what's the benchmark? Because that's really tied to it. What's that advantage that you're going to get from that combination? That's going to be, whether that's an early go, no-go decision or something else, right? Because it's all about that target product profile and how much value you're going to get, which does vary from tumor type and situation.
It's also how much value you're going to get as a decision maker, not necessarily with the next guy.
The human element.
But there is one potential benefit from this immuno-oncology, the magnitude of the benefit. I think in oncology, we very frequently are satisfied with 2 months improvement of something, 1.8 months. You just enroll, you have the money, you enroll 1,000 patients, 200 and 2,000, whatever is the number, and you can show the statistic that it works. But I think immuno-oncology is now showing us that there's actually possibility to clearly change the paradigm and to see, I don't know, 15, 20, 25% of the patients with metastatic melanoma or lung cancer to live 3, 4, 5 years free of disease. And actually, there's a plateau. The recent update on CTLA-4 after 5 years, really, it looks like a diffuse large cell lymphoma, just flat line. So I think that the benchmarking will go higher. And so maybe that will help, that will trim out many of the compounds which historically will make it and will try to improve by 1 month, 2 months, few days, the outcome of the patients, because we can afford it. Maybe the future will be the bar in oncology will go, like in other therapeutic areas, much higher.
So what will happen to the costs of many of these drugs as they're approved in more common indications? So what happens to a PD-1 inhibitor,
right,
now
that's
they're
priced by the initial smaller indication?
Yeah, and that's and I think that's something to so I think that the competition might be good.
Absolutely.
But I think your point is important, Yvonne, because it goes back to some, you know, some of the slides I did earlier today, which were, you know, not to to rah-rah oncology, because, you know, previous 2 years I actually did all the math on those numbers to say at the end of the day, if you apply, you know, various different people's metrics of attrition rates across those different, you still end up with a huge number of drugs for each tumor type. So clearly, you know, a lot of Me Toos is going to be a lot of commercial kills will have to occur, because, you know, you can't sustain, you know, all those drugs in the space. So the magnitude of the benefit that one will be looking for, you know, even very early on, so whether in the model system or in early readouts in humans, has to be going up, particularly in a situation, see, I can't get away from, of immuno-oncology, because it is not just qualitatively, but quantitatively different, right? There are some clients who will kind of disparaging say, yeah, you know, it's the same old thing, isn't it? It's just, but no, it's not. You know, what we're seeing in the percentage of patients right now, you know, relatively small as single agent, you know, 15-20%, but once you do those combinations, those numbers, not, and we're not talking about response rate, we're talking about, you know, the percentage of patients that are having durable remissions, whether that benchmark is 1, 3, 5 years, you know, maybe ultimately longer. So, you know, anyone operating in those spaces or in any other pathway or mechanism that's going to potentially be added on to what might now be a new immuno-oncology-based standard of care needs to think about what their increment will be of being able to add on to that. And that's a pretty high bar, at least as the survival gets longer, which means, you know, many of those companies will start to look at the patients that aren't getting that, the still, you know, immuno-recalcitrant patients. Any other? Okay. Yes, Lou.
Curtailing cost. It's potentially about devising new ways to reward the risk-taking and innovation it takes to adjust the paradigm of how you sequence and or combine things, and those could be, that kind of reward could be patent extension, for example. So there could be something that would propel such innovation forward.
That's a good point. But I do think that it would be greatly facilitated if there were a way to do it in a more, not to tout industrialization because it takes away some of the thought, but certainly issues around combinations could benefit from being able to do it on a broader, faster scale, particularly since you are limited by the number of patients you can actually enroll.
So Gilead was rewarded by their novel combination, huh? I agree with you. I don't think that our political environment is up to rewarding the pharmaceutical and biotech industry with patent extensions or with pricing.
Well, maybe we'll let that comment be the last one. That will balance out the opening session this morning. Then we can take it up again tomorrow. So any other parting comments? I think we're ready to. All right. You ask questions. You may have your cocktails. Be free.